Well, good morning. For those watching and listening online, I want to say thank you. Thank you for taking the time to do that. Man, we hope this morning message inspires you. So we're in this series, and it's called Her, and we're learning about the remarkable stories of six women in the Bible whose courage, whose faith, whose resilience actually shaped history. And they were on the margins of life, and we find them being placed in the center of God's plan. These women remind us that even in our hardest moments, our choices, when they meet God's faithfulness, our lives are no longer the same. Today, we're going to be looking at Tamar and her story. Now, let me ask you a question. Have you ever faced a challenge so overwhelming that you were just trying to escape it? Like, it was just too overwhelming. You wanted to run. You wanted to get away from it. You wanted to avoid it. Maybe it was at work. Maybe it was at home. In those moments, right, it's easy to fall into what researchers at University of Maryland call avoidance mode. Okay, so think of it like a state where your mind shifts to survival. It narrows your focus, your stress increases, your creativity is limited. It's like you're frozen, right? Now, students were placed in two groups, and they were asked to solve a simple maze. Okay, so one group had to guide a mouse toward the exit where there is cheese. The other group had to guide the mouse away from an owl. Did you know that the group that was focused on reaching the cheese was twice as creative as the group fleeing the owl? Why? Because the group pursuing the cheese had an approach mindset. See, they were focused on the reward. They were focused on the opportunity. They were focused on moving forward. They were not living in fear, which allowed them to foster curiosity, which allowed them to have creative problem solving. Now, the group that was trying to avoid the owl was in this avoidance mode. They were focused on survival. They were in fear, and that fear naturally narrowed their options. Okay, so we face that choice all the time. When life feels stacked against us, when it feels unfair, when it feels unjust, it is tempting to default into survival mode, to avoid, to retreat, to simply want to escape the difficulty. But here's the thing. When we're in avoidance mode, we miss the very creativity and courage we need to overcome the challenge. Simply put, we get stuck. What about you? What about the challenge that you're facing right now? Are we defaulting to avoidance mode? We're just trying to survive. We're just trying to keep the peace. We want to escape. We really don't like the situation. We really don't like the relationship, but we just feel stuck, and we're just avoiding the elephant in the room. Or are we able to shift to an approach mindset? We're motivated by the opportunity. It doesn't fear. We are not afraid of the opportunity. We're not living in our fear. And we are motivated by what could come out of the situation. Maybe for you, it's like this broken relationship that you've been avoiding because it's too painful to address. Maybe at work, you saw something go down that was not right, but yet you're afraid to confront it because you don't want to lose your job. Maybe it's submitting an application or a letter of retirement that you've been putting off because the road feels uncertain, it feels unknown, it feels overwhelming. Or maybe it's trying to add to your family, but the news that you've received hasn't been good. Like, whatever it is, y'all, the choice is the same. Like, will we stay stuck in avoidance mode, or will we lean into the approach mindset? And for a follower of Jesus, here's what the approach mindset is. We're trusting that God can use our steps of faith to bring about something greater. Tamar found herself in a situation where she could have easily slipped in avoidance mode. She could have accepted her fate as this forgotten widow, without rights, without a future. But instead, she chose an approach mindset. She moved toward justice. She was creative and she was courageous in finding a way to uphold her family's honor. And in so doing, she actually found a place in the lineage of Jesus. Like, her actions were not conventional, but they were creative because she refused to quit. She refused to avoid. She refused to give in. We're going to see the Tamar story shows us that even when the path seems messy, when it seems unconventional, here's what God does. He honors those who act with courage to make things right. Her actions were not easy. They were not without risk. But they remind us that our faith isn't passive, y'all. Our faith is not passive. Our faith moves. Faith acts. Faith creates opportunities where none seem to exist. What could God, think about this, what could God do through you if you chose to act with that kind of trust in him today? So here's how the story of Tamar goes, and we're going to start with some backstory. At that time, Judah left his brothers and went down to stay with a man of Adullam named Hiram. There Judah met the daughter of a Canaanite man named Shua. He married her and made love to her. So let me kind of give some backstory. You have a guy by the name of Jacob, had 12 sons. Okay. Two of the sons was Judah and Joseph. Judah, one of the brothers, no one liked Joseph. He was like the favorite. So Judah has this great idea in his mind to sell their brother to distant relatives, the Ishmaelites, that were basically human trafficking. So after selling Joseph and lying to their dad that he had been killed by wild animals, Judah decides to leave. He goes south because dad, Jacob, is very depressed over Joseph's death. Then Judah makes another poor decision of marrying a woman who is a Canaanite. So he's rejecting what Abraham insisted. Abraham, who we learned about last week, insisted that his sons and grandsons not marry women from outside their people because Canaanites worship other gods than God. Like even later on in the Old Testament, God made it super clear that his people were not to marry with Canaanites because it would lead them to idolatry and a lifestyle that did not lead to life. So she becomes pregnant, gives birth to a son who is named Ur. She conceived again, gave birth to a son, named him Onan. She gave birth to still another son and named him Shelah. It was at Kizib that she gave birth to him. Now here's what's so interesting. Judah's wife's name is never mentioned. And here's another thing. Shelah's name literally means drawn out of the womb. Perhaps this means that Judah's wife had difficulty giving birth to Shelah. If that's the case, he's their baby boy, right? So Judah got a wife for Ur, his firstborn, and her name was Tamar. But Ur, Judah's firstborn, was wicked in the Lord's sight, so the Lord put him to death. Now, it's very likely that it was an arranged marriage of some sort, that there was this bride price paid for Tamar, and at the end of the day, she was basically dealt for. Now, we have no idea how long they were married, and we have no idea what Ur did to warrant his death. But here's some things we do know about the Canaanites. They were evil people. And maybe Ur followed the culture that Judah placed the family in. Here's what the Canaanites were known for. They were known for sacrificing babies and kids to a god named Molech to secure prosperity. There was constant sex acts in the temples and shrines. And you did those things, you did those acts to secure fertility in your land and livestock. People sought guidance from the spirits and the dead. And they exploited people and had no regard for the sanctity of life. The story continues. Then Judah said to Onan, "Sleep with your brother's wife and fulfill your duty to her as a brother-in-law to raise up offspring for your brother." But Onan knew that the child would not be his. So whenever he slept with his brother's wife, he spilled his semen on the ground to keep from providing offspring for his brother. What he did was wicked in the Lord's sight, so the Lord put him to death also. Now, there was this law called the Levirate Law. It was a responsibility to marry a widow and produce offspring typically fell to the brother of the deceased husband. Now, this was intended to preserve the family line and inheritance. So if no brothers were available, the responsibility would extend to the next closest male relative. Now, the whole purpose of that law was to assure that widows were cared for and did not marry outside the clan. We talked about this last week with Hagar. What did husbands do for their wives? They protected and they provided. When the husband died and they had a son, what did the son do? Yep, they backfilled that role. They provided and protected for their mom. So this is a male-driven society. Women had very few rights. We learned last week that a widow needed a son to provide for her material needs and keep the property of her deceased husband within the family. Onan was all about the act, but not the law. And it seems clear that Onan's selfishness is what got him killed. Like, he understood that he would still have to support their child who would get his brother's estate. Now, Judah then said to his daughter-in-law Tamar, "Live as a widow in your father's household until my son Shelah grows up." For he thought, "He may die too, just like his brothers." So Tamar went to live in her father's household. Now, Shelah would have been next in line, but he's still a kid at the time. Now, there was nothing in the Levirate law prohibiting Judah from giving Tamar to an extended family member. But Judah deceived Tamar. He had no intent to giving Shelah away to Tamar. So Tamar is now put in this desperate situation. She has no future. Her livelihood depended on a husband or a son. The story continues. When Tamar was told, "Your father-in-law is on his way to Timnah to share his sheep," she took off her widow's clothes, covered herself with a veil to disguise herself, and then sat down at the entrance of the town, which is on the road to Timnah. For she saw that though Shelah had grown up, she had not been given to him as his wife. So back then, widows would wear these clothes to show their status. And in this moment, Tamar is fighting deception with deception. Like, she knew that the only way to survive was to understand the law. So the law really stated that if no brothers were available, the responsibility could extend to the next closest male relative, which included the widowed father-in-law. The law did not forbid a father-in-law from marrying his widowed daughter-in-law, but a union like that would have been kind of unusual. Like, Tamar's act of deception was rooted in a desire for justice, even if it meant achieving that justice unconventionally. Like, think of it like this. Like, a modern whistleblower would break their silence or break an NDA or break a law to preserve the integrity and honor of the organization. Very similar. So we're going to continue the story, and yet the story is getting even more crazy. When Judah saw her, he thought she was a prostitute, for she had covered her face. Not realizing that she was his daughter-in-law, he went over to her by the roadside and said, "Come now, let me sleep with you." Notice what she asked. "What will you give me to sleep with you?" And he said, "I'll send you a young goat for my flock." So here's a couple of things. I know some of us are like, are you serious? Like, this is the Bible? Yes, it is. If Judah would have recognized Tamar, I don't think he would have took the next step. I don't think he would have even approached this person and asked to have sex with them. Okay. It also shows that Judah acted out of impulse. He was not ready to pay for sex. And then Judah was a wealthy man. Like, he was not lacking anything. He's like, "Yeah, I'll send you a young goat when I get back." Notice how clever she is. "Will you give me something as a pledge until you send it?" "I know you're a liar, dude." And he said, "What pledge should I give you?" She said, "Your seal and its cord and the staff in your hand." So he gave them to her and slept with her, and she became pregnant by him. After she left, she took off her veil and put on her widow's clothes again. She's super clever, right? She's fighting deception with deception, and asking for the seal and the staff was a brilliant move because the seal and the staff were personalized. The seal and the staff would have had Judah's name or Judah's mark on it. And so Tamar removes her veil. She changes back in her widow's clothes. Now, fast forward the course of about 3 months. Judah cannot locate the temple prostitute. Remember, what was he doing? He's bringing back the what? Yeah, the goat, the young goat. So he's been ghosted, and in that culture, Judah would have been publicly shamed by being outsmarted by a prostitute. And then he gets word that Tamar is guilty of being pregnant, and so he's furious. He wants her burned to death because he expected Tamar to be abstinent and remain available for Shelah. So she's brought out to face her death by being burned alive, and notice what she says. "I am pregnant by the man who owns these. See if you recognize whose seal and cord and staff these are." Judah recognized them and said, "She is more righteous than I, since I wouldn't give her to my son, Shelah." And he did not sleep with her again. In this moment, he knew that he was guilty of deceiving Tamar. He admits his deception. He saves her from being burned alive. And 6 months later, Tamar gives birth to twins, to two sons that Matthew mentions as he's writing Jesus' lineage. Notice, Judah, the father of Perez and Zerah, whose mother was Tamar. Perez, the father of Hezron. Hezron, the father of Ram. And we're going to see how this affects another woman in our series, Ruth. See, Tamar's actions, they were unconventional. They were even deceptive and ultimately woven into God's larger plan to bring Jesus into the world. See, Tamar's story is a reminder that God can use anyone and anything to accomplish his purposes, even when it seems the path is off center or morally complicated. Guys, there are a few takeaways from her act of courage. One, God works through imperfect people. God works through imperfect people. God used her choices to bring about the continuation of the promise he made to Abraham that we talked about last week, that God was going to take this man who has been married but couldn't have any kids, and he was going to build from him a great nation, and out of that nation would come the Messiah, God's final and forever king, who is Jesus, and he was going to bless all nations. God has consistently used flawed people to fulfill his purposes throughout the Bible. God is faithful to his promises, even when human behavior and actions are questionable. He remains committed to his plan. He remains committed to his plan of redemption. He did not let human failure or deception derail it. And Tamar's story teaches that God doesn't wait for perfect people to accomplish his will. He uses ordinary, imperfect people to bring about extraordinary things. Another thing that we see is that God can bring life from impossible situations. Y'all, the fact that Matthew adds this in his biography of Jesus shows that God could take what seems to be broken, what seems to be messed up, and honestly sinful, and use it for his redemptive purposes is incredible. It's a miracle. Tamar's involvement in Jesus' genealogy emphasizes that God has this ability to bring beauty and purpose out of difficult and messy and sinful situations. And what seems like a setback or a mistake or a sin can be used by God to further his ultimate purpose. Man, Tamar's story, y'all, is unexpected. It's messy, but God used it for something awesome. The continuation of his promise to Abraham that one day the Messiah would come. Your story, no matter how messed up, how complicated, how difficult, can be part of God's larger plan. God can use your pain, your courage, your choices to bring about something greater. Another thing that we see is that God honors our courageous acts of faith. Tamar acted in faith to ensure justice for herself, even as the system failed her. Her courageous action did not go unnoticed by God, and in the end, she received justice through the birth of two sons, specifically Perez, who would be the continuation of the family line, and Judah's acknowledgement in front of everybody that she was more right than he was in this situation. Like, think about the areas in your life where courage is needed. It may involve standing up for someone who's been wronged or fighting for what's right, even if it's uncomfortable. Like Tamar, God often calls us to do what others may not understand. I don't want you to miss that. Like Tamar, God often calls us, especially those who are followers of Jesus who live according to his value system and not according to the world's value system, God often calls us to do what others may not understand. And the final thing is that God's plan was never in danger. God's plan was never in danger. Even when Judah delayed in giving Tamar his son, or when she took matters in her own hands, listen, God's plan for her life was never delayed. See, with God being outside of time, not being constrained like Tamar, not being constrained like us, everything fell into place when it needs to fall into place. Many of us can relate to waiting for something in our lives. We're waiting for a breakthrough in our career. We're waiting for a relationship to be restored. We're waiting for a financial provision. We're waiting for a miracle. We're waiting for God to do something incredible. See, sometimes we find ourselves in situations where it feels like God's promises are delayed. It feels like we've been forgotten about. But just as God worked through Tamar's actions to bring about his redemptive plan in his timing, we can trust that he's always working in ways that we may not see. See, Tamar's story reminds us that God is at work even in situations where we're waiting, when we're frustrated, or we have gone through something unexpected. A couple of things I want us to think about this morning. One, are you willing to take a step of faith even when the future seems uncertain? Number two, where is God calling me to act, even if it requires risk or stepping outside of my comfort zone? And number three, will you trust God in the waiting, knowing that his timing is perfect? Well, let's pray together. Heavenly Father, we're incredibly thankful for Tamar's story. We thank you for her act of courage. And Father, some of us may find ourselves in a very similar situation. So first of all, I pray that we will get to know you better when we take a step of faith. Father, for others of us, we believe that you are calling us to act, but maybe for some of us, we've been avoiding it. We've been afraid. We've been living in fear. And I'm asking that we would take a step of risk. We would step outside of our comfort zone and we would trust you as you're calling us to act. And then, Father, that we are trusting you. For some of us, we're waiting and we're trusting you in the waiting. We are believing that your timing is perfect. So, Father, help us to be men and women of courage. In Jesus' name.